A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Let's stick in your eyes.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Well, hi there, and thanks so much for tuning in. And, of course, thanks to our live audience here for coming to ANU campus on this autumnal Canberra evening. Let me recognise that we are recording this on Ngunnawal and Ngambri lands and pay our deepest respects to these First Nations peoples and their elders past and present. I'm Mark Kenny from the School of Politics and International Relations and the Australian Studies Institute, and I'm host of ANU's Democracy Sausage. And this is a special joint episode with our sister podcast, Policy Forum Pod. So it's quite an occasion, actually. We've not done this before, and we've certainly not done it live before, so we're really, really excited about it. And we do thank so many of you for coming out tonight on what is a pretty filthy night in terms of weather. We haven't had these kinds of winter nights this year so far, so as I raced to the campus tonight, I was thinking, oh, it might have some effect on the audience. But Canberrans are a stoic lot, and we're here in large numbers, and I'm really grateful for that. We all are. As you know, both pods are turned out each week with the enormous support of the Crawford School of Public Policy and the College of Asia and the Pacific and the College of Arts and Social Sciences and everyone at ANU. We get a lot of support and a lot of resources. There's a fair bit of back office and logistics associated with these podcasts each week. It's a lot of demand, and we really appreciate all of the support that we get. So let's get down to it. Welcome to Professor Sharon Bessel, who you will all know. Sharon is Professor of Public Policy and Director of both the Children's Policy Centre and the Poverty and Inequality Research Centre at ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. Welcome, Sharon. I don't know if I should say welcome, because it's your podcast as well.
You can say welcome, Mark. That's fine. And it's very exciting to be here, a joint live pod. That's huge, and so good to see so many people here. We're normally in our little capsule alone, so it's very exciting to have people around us.
Yes, there's something very exclusive about a podcast studio, isn't it? You're doing it as a recording, so you're not usually going out live, and it's all sounds, all extraneous. The whole external world doesn't exist for that moment. So, yes, it's quite a turnaround to do this. Also with us, of course, is the co-host of Policy Forum Pod, Dr. Anna Greta Hunter. She's the Human Futures Fellow at ANU College of Health and Medicine. She's a cardiologist, a physician, a senior clinical lecturer at ANU Medical School. And there's a lot of doctors at ANU, of course, but there's only a couple that you could really rely on if you had a heart attack, and Anna Greta is one of them. So let's hope that doesn't happen tonight, but I suppose it's a good bit of health warning for all of us. We've got a doctor in the house.
Good
in
to
the
know.
Real sense.
We'll see how I feel at the end of the show. It is great to be here live. Sharon and I often get really pleased to be in the podcast studio together rather than recording from home, where we have to make excuses for the chickens and the cats and the birds and the animals around the place and the people. And so it is fantastic to be here with a live audience tonight.
Yes, that's actually a really good point, that through a lot of COVID, we didn't even have the luxury of being in little studios. Yep. We were doing it using a program called Zencaster generally, and you know, hopefully for those of you who listened to the podcast, you were thinking, you know, it sounded fine, and you weren't really noticing, but there would have been the odd dog barking and person bursting into the room, as happens in households. Yes, it's been quite a journey we've all been on, and, of course, everyone's sitting here with masks tonight, and we really appreciate that as well. Also with us tonight, Maria Tuflaga is not with us, unfortunately. She has to be elsewhere, but we've got an excellent stand-in for Maria. We've got Professor Nicholas Biddle, who's been on the podcast before. He's Associate Director of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods and Director of the new Policy Experiments Lab. Nick is also the co-author of a paper just about to come out, actually, arising from the results of the latest but yet to be released ANU poll, which asks 3,500 voters their attitudes to many things. And it's one of the largest surveys, I think probably is, Nick, the largest survey that is done of voter attitudes during this election.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me here. And it was really nice to see everyone kind of in the live audience. And I think this is, I've been on both podcasts, and so it's nice to be the guinea pig for the first joint podcast. And, you know, the high wire act of doing it live is really exciting. And yeah, as Mark mentioned, we kind of run a survey and have been doing so for the last couple of years. And really excited to kind of preview some of the findings here and kind of get people's reactions and thoughts on kind of the issues of the day.
Yeah, can we just start there? Because polling obviously has a bit of a sullied name after what happened in 2019. In fact, what happened in 2016 is not a bad point to make as well about Brexit and the election of one orange demagogue in the US. Both outcomes that didn't seem to comply with the understanding of where public opinion was. So polling's, where do you see it? It's a science, it's an art, and it's also one of those things where, I guess, consistent with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, has the ability to affect its whatever it's trying to observe.
Yeah, so, and I guess polling works most of the time, except when you want it to, and that's around tight elections. You know, there's the elections which are, you know, pretty consistently one party's been behind for quite some time. It's pretty easy to kind of predict what's going to happen. So I think the examples you gave, the 2019 election in Australia and the 2016 kind of votes, were tight elections, and there was uncertainty around it. I think the other thing which we're, as pollsters, are grappling with, or as survey statisticians are grappling with, is people just don't do surveys anymore. And it's actually really hard to get a good sample of people. And what you end up with is the opinionated. And they're the ones who say yes to doing the surveys, and they're obviously not representative of the population. So we try really hard in our surveys to kind of get a broad sway of the people to get a sense of where the biases are. But at the same time, while we do ask kind of questions on political attitudes, we're not brave enough to predict the election. We'll kind of it'd be a little bit more circumspect than I think some of the other pollsters might be.
Yes, perhaps leave that to the political commentators to get wrong, as I did last time. And so many of my contemporaries.
Well, it's good to be wrong in a crowd. It's worse being wrong when you're by yourself.
You mentioned the challenge of getting a representative sample. The way pollsters tend to handle that, I mean, they go out of their way to try and address changing social habits. So the fact that we don't have landlines anymore, for example, is a big change in the way that pollsters go about trying to reach a representative group of Australian voters. And then they do this thing called weighting, yep, don't they?
So if you kind of know kind of characteristics for the population, and you have those characteristics on the survey, you can kind of adjust. And one of the things which where the US election at least got it wrong is they waited for the wrong things. So you know, previously kind of age, sex, location was kind of the main predictors of voting preference. And in the US election in 2016, it was education background, which was really kind of which split the vote. And because there was most of the polls didn't weight by education, they kind of waited for the wrong thing.
It sounds like the story of my life, really, waiting for the wrong thing.
And the other thing is you can't wait for things you don't have on your survey. So, or you don't, for which you don't have kind of benchmarks for. And, you know, things like enthusiasm. Well, what's the benchmark for enthusiasm? Or kind of knowledge about the candidates. There's nothing really which you can benchmark against. So it's hard. I think at least this time around, most of the polling companies are talking more about uncertainty, kind of talking more about the undecided, which I think was kind of the Australian experience, was that last time there was a lot of people going into the election who are undecided, and to predict where they go is quite difficult. So there has been an improvement, I think, and some genuine attempts to really, not make more of the data than it's able to. And I think that's really helped, hopefully helped the discussion. And like you said, meant that the polling has driven the policy maybe a little bit less than it did in previous elections.
So let's get to what some of the findings that you do have in this, and I guess that can from that we can drive some discussion about what the policy implications are for it. I understand that one of the key findings that you can talk about is that the ANU poll shows that about two-thirds or nearly two-thirds of voters put cost of living as the number one issue.
Yeah, so that's probably not a huge surprise when you kind of see what kind of politicians are responding to. But I guess for us, we've been kind of tracking kind of COVID and COVID outcomes, well-being outcomes, mental health outcomes, and people's views on the pandemic. So we put a question with about 22 kind of priority areas. And got the respondents to rank or at least to say which ones they thought were kind of top priority and which ones were lower priority. And we went into it thinking, okay, well, COVID is going to be top, and then we'll look at the rest. And that clearly was not the case. From our data, was not the case. What people saw as being important was cost of living, aged care. So more than 60% of people said that it's a top priority in Australia to fix the aged care system. And, you know, COVID was right down. It was lower than in the US when people were asked a similar question. And you can kind of see how we're almost dealing with a kind of a COVID hangover, where the policy responses to COVID have been pretty successful in Australia, low-ish kind of infection rates, a little bit less now, pretty low mortality rates, pretty good in terms of kind of vaccination rates. But that's been kind of generated off the back of a lot of spending by government and a lot of kind of pent-up demand, which is now kind of flowing through to inflation and also into, as we saw kind of yesterday, kind of interest rate changes. So it's certainly in our data feels like a post-COVID response far earlier than perhaps we were thinking it might have been.
Nick, can I ask, when you asked about cost of living, what did you actually ask around that? So what's sitting behind cost of living? Is it including housing? Is it petrol prices?
We've kind of attacked cost of living in a few ways. So we just had a simple question amongst the list of priorities, which is reducing the cost of living. So, and we've kind of allowed people to interpret that in whatever they want to. But we've also asked a range of other questions. So one is whether people thought that prices were going to go up more this year than they did last year. And what'd be surprised to know that a vast majority of people said yes, the prices have got more this year than last year. And we know that inflation is, you know, people's inflation expectations are both backward looking, but also they lead to inflation. If everyone thinks prices are going to go up, then people put up prices. So we also asked about whether you feel that you can get by on your current income. So for our survey, we're actually really kind of lucky that we ran a massive survey in February 2020. So we thought, you know, we were approached by the European Social Survey to run an Australian version. And our response was, well, Australia's in Eurovision, it might as well be in the European Social Survey.
It was
an ex post rationalization. So we did this massive survey in February 2020, and not, you know, COVID was something might happen at some stage to Australia, and who cares? You know, something's happening in China. Maybe we'll collect some data about it at some stage. So we went in the field, and that's given us a whole bunch of baseline data. So we have data from both January and February 2020 of kind of pre-COVID data. And one of the really fascinating findings from our first COVID survey was that a much higher proportion of people thought that their income was enough to get by on in the early stages of COVID compared to February 2020 just prior. And I was like, well, is that right? Did we ask this question right? You know, have we done something stupid? Because that's possible. and no, the data, both our data and other data, kind of held up. You know, and it kind of makes sense. You know, what did people have to spend money on? And now in April 2022, in our most recent survey, that measure of income not being sufficient for expenditure is at its highest level since kind of pre-COVID. So I think so as I said, we're kind of attacking that cost of living in a range of ways and trying to get a sense of what aspects of cost of living are affecting people, what the distribution is of people being affected, who thinks prices are going up compared to who thinks prices aren't going up, to really trying to get to the bottom of that really amorphous concept of cost of living, which means different things to different people and in some ways can mean whatever you want it to mean.
Anna Greta, I'm worried that, you know, when we think about a thing like cost of living being at the top of the list, that it becomes kind of like a fire blanket on aspirations in just about every other area. That political parties play to that because it's a here and now problem, you know, the hip pocket problem. We know people tend to vote in that way, and it really means that the aspirations of both the electorate and the representatives become this kind of it becomes this sort of almost direct and instrumental relationship about keeping prices down or delivering relief as we see at the moment, rather than lifting the gaze and thinking about the longer term and where we want the country to be, not just where we want the country to be, you know, at the next on the 21st of May, for example, or 2 months or 6 months from now, but also where we want it to be 5 years from now.
2030 or 2050 or 2030 maybe the end of the century, yeah. You know, yeah. Particularly as we're thinking about issues around climate change.
Yeah, and climate change is a great example because it's always up there, and I think in your survey it's up there at number three, right?
Yeah, yep. Number three.
But if it's not ahead of cost of living, then it's always going to be dominated by cost of living, because all you have to do, and we've seen this happen in previous elections, is run the argument that your electricity prices are about to go up, and it doesn't matter that it's number three, because it's not number one, it doesn't turn someone's vote.
So as we were talking about bringing together Democracy Sausage and Policy Forum for a live pod around the election, one of the drivers for this conversation was the difference between policy, thinking about policy problems, thinking about the big challenges, the sorts of conversations that Sharon and I have had over the course of the beginning of this year, big issues like climate adaptation, problems with mammalian extinction, imagining what the future might be, how we can improve our politics and how we can improve our engagement, what people actually want from their politics. And so that's one side of it, is we've got major problems. We've also got an extraordinary suite of policy solutions. And we seem to get stuck, don't we? I don't know if anybody in the audience would like to agree, but we do seem to get stuck in this translation of actually taking our policy solutions and seeing them play out, particularly when the issues are medium term or long term. The solutions will be over a couple of years or over a generation or two into the future. cost of living might actually be a substitute for this. When we're worrying about cost of living, we're quite often worrying about where we're at, our personal security, our housing, our accommodation, our employment, our access to care. And these are some of the issues that come up frequently when we're talking about policy problems. Access to healthcare. Can I afford to see a doctor? Am I going to be able to be cared for if I need to be in residential care, if I'm going to need hospitalisation? These are some of the anxieties that I suspect are being reflected when we're saying, hey, I'm worried about the cost of living. I'm worried about whether my country can care for me into the future. And so the challenge of now is how our politics responds to that cry for help and whether we continue to focus then on the short term, you know, let's patch this up and give another $250 to this particular subset so they vote for us, or whether we can create a world and particularly a politics where that policy is translated.
Yes. Now, I should say we have a microphone down the front here and we're not going to do the standard thing of, you know, having sort of questions at the end, although we're happy to do that. But also if you want to join this conversation or if you want to put a question to take the conversation in another direction, if you want to make your way down to that microphone and once I've seen you and at a suitable point, I'll invite you to make your observation or question, ideally with a question mark at the end, as Colin Steele always says.
Mark, while people are thinking about coming down and joining the conversation, and please do, I just want to pick up on this issue of the cost of living as well. And I think I agree with what Anna-Greta is saying, that it is almost code for a whole range of anxieties that people are feeling at the moment. And we've already seen in the election campaign how it's almost become a slogan. You know, we will address the cost of living. We will reduce the cost of living. We'll fix this for you, without kind of unpacking what it is that sits behind that slogan of the cost of living. And one of the things that strikes me that I think we really need to be very conscious of is that while the increasing cost of living impacts on everyone, it impacts on some more than others. And what we're not hearing very much conversation around at all, and very little in terms of policy, are those people who were already living below or at the poverty line. And so I think if we see the cost of living becoming a mainstream issue, then it kind of has an upward effect. For all good reason, of focusing on, you know, on people who are perhaps struggling, who are very anxious, and we need to be concerned about that, but diverting attention away from people who are really struggling. And you know, I think if we look at the pre-pandemic statistics around poverty, you know, 35% of single parent households, overwhelmingly women, were living in poverty. You know, about 18% of children live in single-parent households, but over 35% of those live in poverty. No, actually, it's around 40% of those live in poverty. And so I think when we talk broadly about the cost of living without kind of unpacking that, it's likely to divert our attention away from the people who are really in the greatest need in our society.
Mm. And it's easy for a slogan, isn't it, that we're going to focus in on the cost of living. Policy interventions maybe require nuanced economics, you know, a government that was prepared for an interest rate rise, that was thinking about particularly how to care for those who are at the precarious edge of society. As we can see, the likelihood of economic precarity into the future. We know that all of the forecasting, and I'm not an economist, but all of the forecasting on economic recovery after COVID would suggest complexity, would suggest challenge, and would suggest adversity is likely to rise, particularly for those who are in a precarious position. We had an opportunity 6 months ago, 12 months ago to prepare for this. We still have an opportunity now, but it does require this translation of good quality policy through our politics to achieve an end for our society.
Astrid, I see you're at the microphone. Why don't we invite you to put your proposition.
Thanks, Mark. It's actually quite interesting that you guys were talking about diversity and inclusion and things like that, because my question relates to the cost of living, but not just that. The NDIS has proved to be an absolute debacle in our political system. I represent an organisation called Journability News who try to raise these issues at press club to ask the politicians, what the hell are you doing for our disabled people? Where do you guys actually see this going? Because the Liberals have said that they're going to be fully funding the system, but those of us that know That funding is actually just a restoration of the cuts that were made 2 years ago. And they've also changed the rule in that the NDIA CEO can now change people's plans without informing them.
It's a good question.
Can I maybe start with this? And I know Anna Greta's going to comment on this. I think Nick might as well. Look, I think we've been on people who listen to Policy Forum Pod regularly will know that Anna Greta and I kind of run a hashtag and a conversation. It's more than a slogan around valuing care. And I think, you know, to me, there's a fundamental principle that has been lost around the NDIS and around thinking about people with disability in our society. And I think for people with a disability, the word care can carry a lot of baggage. But I think, you know, we have lost the fundamental principle that at the heart of thinking about disability policy needs to be care for the human beings who need that support. So I think that that's the first thing that I think we need to put back. But I also just wanted to pick up on the politics and the policy of this. And I think back to that debate where the Prime Minister was asked by the mother of a boy living with autism what his response was to the fact that his package had been cut. And this to me is one of the worst examples of politics taking over in this election. Now, I think the Prime Minister's response was inappropriate. However, the important part of that exchange was that that little boy suddenly was not receiving the support that he needed. It sounded as though that package may well have been cut without any consultation or without his parents knowing. And this speaks to a massive policy issue. And the fact that we focused on the politics for weeks is in some ways understandable because of the nature of the response, but is unforgivable because this is such an important policy issue. And the opportunity to talk it through was simply lost because the politics took over.
Can we play the ball, not the man? Can we look at the long-term solutions? Can we find those structural changes? And I think we've had at least 10 years and potentially longer where we've really struggled to translate policy into good practice in the Australian context. You know, all of those words, Sharon, that you've used to describe the concerns that many of us will share around the NDIS. And I've looked after so many people and I've heard so many stories of struggles around NDIS funding. And it seemed to be working much more effectively when it first came out, and it's become an increasing source of stress for families and for those who are trying to live their best life. And exactly resonant with the conversation we had just recently on aged care, and the dignity that we would all want from an aged care experience. You know, what do we want out of life? As we age, we want to have dignity, we want to be cared for, we want to be able to have our best life available to us. And that's not just for us, but most of us want that for those around us. We want that as a society. I believe that Australians want to be able to care for each other. And I think our politics is failing us in that translation.
Let's just take a quick break there and we'll be back in a moment.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. It was a really interesting discussion we were just having a moment ago about the NDIS. I mean, it strikes me that like looking at the sort of the macro politics of it, the NDIS is a net positive. It's an extraordinary reform that came in. It has bipartisan support. It's extremely expensive to run. And it's it's a good thing, of course, that this this massive funding mechanism was eventually found and legislated and provides or at least endeavours to provide the service that it does. I mean, it speaks to a couple of things, and I think it speaks to a problem we have in aged care as well and in childcare, and that is that for too long we've been prepared to have certain people in society carry the costs of these sorts of things, sort of off balance sheet, as it were, just simply not paying them, having carers whose lives are completely dominated by the care that they're giving. Have other people who are the receivers of that care, their opportunities circumvented because they have inadequate support and so forth, and that's also true of aged care, and it's also true in different dimensions for childcare. And so we're seeing some movement there, but the NDIS at the same time has proved to be this highly complex organisation. Its funding base is a constant source of political tension, and we see these terrible human stories emerging of people being summarily cut off or excluded after a period of time, or required to jump through enormous numbers of hoops to prove that they are still eligible for the assistance that they get. So, somewhere in all that, I don't know, anyone else want to make a comment?
Mark, I just wanted to pick up on that, because across a whole range of policy issues, we see individual people who need support, as every single one of us does at some point in our lives. You know, Richard Titmuss back in the 1950s talked about natural dependencies, you know, the fact that at some point in our lives, all of us need support. But across the policy areas that should be there to support people who are most in need, we see exactly what you're describing, of people being required to prove for themselves, to jump through hoops. But the other side of that is we've seen a lot of this delivery and administration outsourced. And so there are some sectors of our society that are actually doing very, very well from these approaches. And that privatisation and outsourcing means that often policies become very, very expensive, or programs become very expensive. But we also shift what the focus is from people to profits. And so I think around social policy, we need some really deep thinking and conversation in this country about how we want delivery to take place and what we want to be the driver of that delivery.
Let's move on from that to another aspect of ANU poll. I was going to call it ANU poll, but that sounds like some sort of hemorrhoid cream. That being the very interesting numbers that you get about primary support for the two sides. I think just looking for my notes here, for Labor, for Labor, you've got primary support at about 34.3%, and for the Coalition at 31.2%. Now that's the Coalition, mind, not just the Liberal Party. So that, if you consider that, Labor will have a significant, and you've got the Greens at a high number, I noticed.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. The Greens, and this has certainly been picked up in other polls as well.
Yeah, the Resolve poll earlier this week had it at 15%, right?
Yeah, and so Greens in our survey is kind of picked up support, and I think that we've kind of talked about the election campaign so far and kind of the stumbles of Labor, but that hasn't translated into any change in support for the Coalition. It's kind of moved to the Greens and to a lesser extent the Independents, and you would expect those flows to go back into Labor.
Yeah, well, that's been the practice in the past. I'm sorry, my microphone needs Viagra, I think. It just keeps drooping. That's certainly been the case, though, in the past, that we've seen a very strong flow of preferences from the Greens to the Labor Party. But a 15% share of the vote, of the primary vote for the Greens in Resolve, and I think you've got 16.
Yeah, that's about 16%.
Yeah. Now, that would actually predate, presumably, the Resolve survey.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so our survey was essentially went into the field just as the election campaign was being called, and so, yeah, it's pretty consistent.
But
and
they're in the same ballpark,
sure,
right?
Yes, so, exactly.
And that's a fair bit higher than the Greens normally score at elections. So it may be telling us something. We may look at this afterwards and think about this discussion and think, well, actually, the Greens had a good election because they were cutting through.
Yeah, and you can kind of see that in the priority areas which we've identified, which would be traditional grounds for the Greens to do well. I mean, people get worried about climate change. You know, the Greens have been focused on cost of living and especially the lower part of the income distribution for many elections and care as well, as you mentioned. And so it's a the things which people are caring about at the moment, the policy challenges which we're facing at the moment are helpful for the Greens in terms of them telling an interesting and a different story. Whether that translates into votes and in particular for a minor party, whether it translates into seats and representation is another thing. But at the very least, it kind of shows that there's an appetite for people who are arguing for more action on climate change and related things.
Yeah, are you surprised by those numbers?
Yes. So I certainly didn't expect. What we tend to see is that during an election campaign, the interest in the kind of the flirtation with the minor parties disappears, and it kind of as the opposition, whoever that may be, and the government take on more attention and a greater focus. I mean, there's still the leaders' debates are still framed around Albanese versus Morrison rather than a breadth of political parties and views. But that certainly hasn't been the case this time. And I think that's partly driven by the issues, as I said, but also the independent candidates. And that should be that'll be quite interesting to see what happens this election. And we saw last time that kind of there was skepticism about how well the independents will do. And I think that's happened again. And the skepticism is still there. But I think at the very least it's changed the focus, the debate a little bit.
Nick, one of the questions that many of the independents, particularly the teal candidates, are running on is integrity.
Yep.
Is that something that you asked about in the survey?
Yeah, we didn't actually ask about that specifically, but one of the interesting things in our survey, so we asked about priorities, borrowing questions from the US, and it's nice to have a low bar. And certainly in Australia, the apparatus of government is not as salient an issue as it is at least in the US. And I think there's a perhaps less salience around or less focus on a federal ICAC equivalent than amongst the general public than there might be in Canberra, at least. I hate to use the word Canberra bubble, but it is an issue which I think is, at least for our respondents, less important than, as you said, kind of the issues which are more directly related to them. So whether it's a and this is an area where there's real policy differences between the, I guess, what you call the three major parties and the independents as well. So it'd be interesting to see where that does translate into votes.
What about trust? Because trust in government is the other issue that's been raised across the political spectrum, and you certainly see that in the freedom marches and the people who are responding to Clive Palmer's advertising, that whether trust in government is something that has been lost. Do we know what the population thinks?
That's another kind of question which we've been tracking kind of during the COVID period, and across the world there was a large increase in kind of confidence and trust in government during COVID. And for some countries, that kind of eroded pretty quickly. But in Australia, it held out for quite some time. But now, essentially, confidence in the federal government is back to what it was during the bushfires. And
was that a low point?
Back in the
it should have been a low point.
So yeah, that's a pretty low bar. Yeah. So okay,
right. You can't see through the smoke.
Yeah. No, yeah, no. Yeah. So I think it's, at least in the Australian context, there was a sense during the COVID period that, for the most part, you know, government sometimes being dragged to that point were for the most part implementing policies which were, you know, pretty much you know, keeping Australia the levels and outcomes in Australia were pretty good when you look across the world, and that dividend from that is gone, and you can see that in kind of the campaigning. Like you would think that a leader of a country which has done so well during COVID would be kind of front and center, but I don't think that it's that Morrison sees it as a much of a vote winger, his record on COVID, which is, I think, is interesting.
Well, we did care. We cared quite actively as a government for a good period of time. You know, we fixed homelessness. We made sure everybody was secure in their housing.
We fixed homelessness because it actually was important to the people who were in homes.
Mm. Yes.
Not really because it was important to the people who didn't have them.
And you can argue that it's always an issue that we fix homelessness and care for all elements of our society. But we've managed to ignore it again. And we fixed poverty. You know, we fixed poverty. We took children out of poverty, and we did that for 6 months, and we gave people dignity and security in their life. And so we should have been impressed with a government that could care for its people in such an extraordinary way.
Well, and also we saw governments working together for the first time. I mean, really, for the first time in any of our lifetimes, we saw the Federation, notwithstanding, you know, some grandstanding around the edges and stuff. We essentially saw the levels of government, National Cabinet, working together in problem-solving mode.
And we did see a bit of bickering too.
There was a bit of bickering, and I don't think you can talk about the whole period in a sort of a single or universal make generalizations.
No.
But through the worst of it in those early days of 2020, I think you could say that the level of cooperation between governments, and indeed the actions that were taken by state governments, very decisive actions. The Commonwealth's most decisive action was closing the international border. But then, of course, there was a lot of bickering around, you know, whether you should go to the footy and when you should wear masks and whether you should and all that. But broadly, in the major policy decisions, our governing system worked in ways but it was supposed to, but rarely did.
So, Mark,
but I think we – so just on that, I think that one of the reasons that – you know, we had a very positive response in terms of trust and how people saw the government during that period. But then when we came to the point of rolling back some of the coronavirus supplements and thinking about the pathway forward, we saw a complete failure on the part of the federal government, particularly to draw the lessons from what had been done. So, yes, we can respond to homelessness and we can reduce it dramatically. Yes, we can respond to poverty and we can reduce it dramatically. But we're not going to take any of those lessons on board. We're actually going to take a policy decision to move back in a different direction. And so I think if there's anything that's going to perhaps erode trust, it's seeing that solutions are available and then seeing a policy decision that we're not going to take those lessons on board and we're not going to follow through into the future to think about what kind of country we want. And I think that's one of the great tragedies. Mm. There are many tragedies to come out of the pandemic, but one of them is that we didn't take that moment to really reflect on how we can think differently about policy solutions and how we could learn from what we'd done during those early months or that first period of 2020.
And I think one of the other interesting things is the exposure to the social security system, which many people would not have had for years. And when you look at both our survey data as well as the admin data, the people who'd moved on to that system were drastically different to those who'd been on the system for years. And I think that could have translated into a understanding of the complexity of the social security system. It probably did. And the benefit of it during times of national crisis. But that didn't seem to translate into kind of the benefits of the social security system for times of individual crisis and that people's experience of that is kind of almost been forgotten. And I think that's not a failure of them necessarily. It's kind of a failure of our government and the political system to not build on that and kind of leverage that for a policy response, which then is more generous to people for whom that's normal. That kind of pre-COVID, that was kind of the experience of having to deal with Centrelink, having to provide forms and all that stuff.
And of course, what lots of people were having to provide at that point was considerably less than what people would normally have to provide. But I absolutely agree, Nick. It could have been a time of bringing people together. But we instead saw those divisions very quickly.
But could it really? I mean, this is the political realist in me talking, right? You have a conservative government, you know, pro-market government, talks always about balancing budgets, about living within your means, all of those types of things, very pro-business, right? It finds itself in the hot seat at this moment. It suddenly, by force of having no other choice, pulls this hyper-Keynesian lever and starts borrowing billions and pumping it into the economy and taking all kinds of other, you know, expanding the role of government dramatically. Yes, there are a number of long-standing policy solutions that are found to things like homelessness and even just to a whole range of sort of social practices. But for that government to then say, we're going to change the nature of the economy, we're going to change the nature of the relationship between Australians and their government, we're going to change at a fundamental level what it is that we conceive of as government, that's an almost impossible thing to imagine a Liberal National Party government doing.
I think it goes to the heart of what we're talking about today.
Yeah,
because it speaks to the politics always trumping the possibility for deep policy conversation.
Yep.
And I think you're right, Mark. You know, the possibility of a Morrison-led coalition taking that kind of approach.
Well, we saw they did
a
Turnbull
when
he had much more modest ambitions than that, and he was too moderate for them, too progressive for them.
But it's because we fall back into the political or the ideological positions, you know, rather than thinking, you know, where would the policy take us here?
Yeah, political binaries, really.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think this is the frustration. I think this is the frustration that we're seeing manifest in the growing support for the independents, particularly the teal independents. So many of them speak in an articulate way about solutions that are not framed in a short-termism framework, but are actually giving a long-term intergenerational view in terms of policy solutions to difficult problems that many of us are not wanting to run away from, but we're actually wanting to face head-on. And so I think there's a tremendous appetite in our politics, that means in our voters, to change the discourse, to move away from the binary politics
and to
reframe.
Yeah. We hope there is, but we also notice that they say cost of living is their most, please fix that for
potentially
me
as a cry for help. I'm interested in why COVID's not an issue, and I don't know if it should be an issue during the election campaign. I'm not really sure whether there's that much appetite to talk about it. We've been talking about it for 2 years where so many people are over it. But we do see this growing mortality from our COVID infection every day. We're seeing our numbers going up. We've got more people infected now than we did 6 months ago. Most of us have now had some exposure, if not been infected ourselves. 25% or so of the Canberra population certainly had COVID by now. Why isn't it an election issue? How did we manage to put this into a basket of something that no longer interests us? Nick, did that come from your survey?
Yeah, so I don't know the exact answer to that, and I think that's quite a complex kind of thing to unpack. I think partly it's that fatigue, and having talked about COVID for years, I think there's a desire to move on. I think it's also hard for the two major parties to create a distinction on. So I'd be if Morrison ran on kind of his response or the government's response to COVID, then kind of the vaccine rollout can kind of it kind of opens.
Bring it on, I think Labor would say.
Well, yes, but then on the other hand, Labor, it's hard for Labor also to make too much of it, because what were they saying which was that different? So it's hard for them to run against kind of JobKeeper.
They thought of it.
Yeah, and they kind of also argue that, well, they do kind of make a point around the expenditure on JobKeeper, which was far greater than it perhaps should have been. But that's kind of it's like a JobKeeper versus a slightly different JobKeeper. That's a pretty hard thing to cut through on. I think the lack of difference between the Coalition and Labor over the last couple of years on COVID has meant that it's a bit hard for it to be a big election issue.
In the time that we've got left, can I that's an interesting point to sort of make this parallel, right, about the 2019 election, bearing in mind what we've been through since. But the lesson of the 2019 election for the Labor Party was clearly don't try and govern the country from opposition. Don't put a large amount of policy into the public sphere, because you will get smashed about for it. It'll give Morrison, who's very good at sort of using this, it'll give him material to use against you. So we see a Labor Party now that in policy terms, I mean, Nick, you made a very good point a second ago about, you know, there not being any policy difference. I mean, it's essentially the case with with tax cuts, with all kinds of expenditures, with you know, most of the things that happened through the pandemic, but a whole range of things that have happened since, even in the budget, even the $250 for pensioners, the one-off increase to the low and middle income tax offset, all of these things Labor has just waved through because it doesn't want to give the government, you know, doesn't want to give Morrison room to swing the bat effectively. So I suppose that I'm raising this to put to you all the question of, you know, are we at a situation now where politics is so febrile that the only policy that can be done, the only reforming and imaginative policy that can be done, has to be done by governments within government terms rather than, you know, thinking and trying to sell an imaginative image to an electorate ab initio?
Yeah, I think there's to a certain extent, but I think I think one of the challenges with the 2019 election was not that people weren't supportive of each of the individual Labor policy proposals, and when we kind of looked at as best we could, kind of capturing for support for each individual kind of policy, then they almost all had majority support. But if you get kind of 70%
aggregate, was
exactly,
it?
Yeah. So you get 70% support for this, and then 70% support for that. You add up those 30%, and you get to the point where people find something they don't like, and that's what they vote on. So I think to me, the lesson is not that you can't do big policy and you can't have big policy debates. You can't have big policy debates around 30 issues. And I think that's what the challenge is. And I think that's what Albanese has been trying to do. Whether it's been effective or not is another thing. But I think having a...
We'll soon know. Yeah.
Did
either of you want to comment on that? Because it's a pretty deep sort of question.
It's a key question. And again, I think that's what a lot of people are going to be voting for, is the prospect of seeing policy change or seeing meaningful policy introduced. And that is regardless of whether you're voting for an independent or the government, the Liberal National Coalition, voting Labor, voting for a Green member of parliament. People are voting because they do want to see policies either continued or change, and changing significantly. If we create government where the focus of change is only during that first bit before you start to get into election mode, and we know that can be quite quickly afterwards, are we going to be able to solve problems like climate change, like intergenerational poverty, like our education system, like how our public service works?
Like housing.
Like housing affordability. We're undermining ourselves, I think, if we put all of the focus into such a short period of time. And you can see it coming out in the conversations. ICAC, which is separate to government because government can't solve this on its own, putting out a climate change roundtable structure or taking away the decision-making from the hands of the politics, because it's so important that we need to do that. Will we need to create that sort of structure for all of our major policy challenges? That would seem to be a pity in terms of, I think I'd regard that as a failure of our government. I think we need to be able to introduce back into our government system better nuance and capacity for seeing the intergenerational view.
Sharon?
I think there is another issue here that we need to really think about, which is the nature and the ownership of media in Australia. And I think that does really impact on the extent to which policy debates can be had and the way they're presented. And so I don't think, in response to your question, Mark, we can completely separate that out, because I think it is so fundamentally important. And I think where we perhaps have the potential, depending on what the next parliament looks like, is if we do see more independence coming through, there may be greater space to think about or to debate what the vision is for the country, what long term we want the country to look like, and then what policies fall under that. Because I think one of the real challenges at the moment is, it's the point that Nick made, we're kind of debating 30 different policies in sound bites, but not dealing substantively with any of them.
Or what links them together.
Yeah, exactly.
The sort of coherent narrative.
Exactly. Yeah. The government's leading with bonus fever. You know, we'll just throw a short-term temporary piece of cash here or there. And within that, there's no space for, yeah, what is the connection? What is the vision? What is the coherence here? And where do we have scope for cross-party collaboration, you know, for the bipartisanship on the issues that really matter? But while we're kind of stuck in the toxic politics that we are at the moment, it's very hard for that to happen.
One of the things about this election, we've remarked about it here, everyone in this room would be well aware of it, would be the rise of these independents. I wonder if I could just this is going to be offensively unscientific. That's to fine. You, Nick. But,
do you know the 47% of statistics are made up on the spot? Well,
I heard it was 80. But I'm after a show of hands as to people who would like to see, because let me just frame the question a bit better. There's a narrative running in Australia at the moment, particularly being run by the Coalition and its media backers, that sort of starts from the proposition that independents ipso facto are bad, that they would lead to greater instability, chaos, as the PM said today, you know, and he's sort of warning of this whole Labor Greens independence chaos thing. But the independents that I've seen operating in the parliament at the moment are among the very best legislators in place. So I'm just wondering, put up your hand if you think there should be more independence and less party dominance. Well, there we are. See, that's a pretty clear majority, I think.
Nick,
I think
you have 99%.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting in itself, isn't it? But this is perhaps not a very representative audience. We are in Canberra. We are in ANU, after all.
I think everyone's looking for good discussion and debate. You know, I speak to people across a fairly broad spectrum in a consulting room environment, and it's a crazy place to sort of get the political temperature. But it means I've spoken to people who will be voting One Nation and voting for their freedom in the future because they're concerned about what's been happening, whose scientific understanding is sometimes different to mine and whose political understanding might be at a different end of the spectrum. Everybody wants to be heard. They want to be participating in a discussion. We want to be able to bring together the different sides of the debate. And so I think that's part of what we'll see out of the independents is the capacity for collaboration and bringing those stories together.
If we get those independents.
I've been saying.
We also have the Australia United Party or Palmer United Party, whatever it is, and One Nation. And, you know, we have a whole range of political views being represented.
No, that's true. Yeah. But most of those are in Senate races. And what's interesting about these independents is they're in House of Reps races, and that could therefore be really important in terms of the makeup of the parliament, in terms of which side, if there is a hung parliament as it's described. And I've seen Bruce Guthrie, former editor, I think he was editor of The Age at one stage, made the point the other day that we shouldn't even be using this term hung parliament because it's a pejorative depiction of what would be a legitimate representation of electoral will. And I agree with that. And I think there's no reason to believe that in many other legislatures around the world, minority governments are quite common and negotiating. In fact, Alfred Deakin, I remember reading Judith Brett make this point in one of her excellent essays on Alfred Deakin. She made the point that Deakin actually preferred to be dealing from a minority position because he accepted, this is in his first prime ministership, I think, he accepted that this led to better quality legislative outcomes if you had to talk with people and reach compromises, that it actually improved government policy on the ground. So That's what's different.
How about that? That if democracy reflects the people.
Yeah, and this is a father of the Liberal Party in a way. Yeah.
I think Howard would have much rather to have had work choices kind of rejected by having to negotiate with the Senate than kind of what actually happened in 2007. So there's a sense that
well, exactly. In 2004 he won the lower house easily and he won control of the Senate. That's right. And it's one of those be careful what you wish for moments because they went too far and they had that problem. And now, of course, we had Howard yesterday or a couple of days ago describing these independents as political groupies, which I just thought was utterly appalling. And I had a chap say to me this morning that if you grew up in the 60s, that meant something, you know, and it isn't good. It's certainly not a good way to talk about what are very, very serious, very highly credentialed candidates.
But, Mark, we can also rest assured that John Howard doesn't think there's a housing crisis. So.
No, that's right. That's right. And I think we should say as a sort of a sobering coda on that the system is not set up for independents to make it in the lower house, and it is quite possible. You've probably heard me say this before, but it's quite possible that they all do well, or a good many of them will do quite well, and yet none of them might get elected. That is a distinct possibility, and in a way, I fear for what that will do to some people's levels of hope and optimism around around this question. I think we're going to have to wrap up there. I usually don't like to wrap up with me talking last, but unless anyone wants to make any final observations.
We have 2 weeks or so, don't we, until the election, and anything can happen in that period of time. And so, I think for those who are listening and who are voting in Australia, it's a good time to sit down and look at who your options might be.
Yeah, that's a very good point. There's a couple of weeks to go in this race yet, and things can happen.
And I think regardless of the outcome, aiming to keep the focus consistently on policy issues and the importance of policy debate and developing good policy is essential. You know, and so I think, you know, this is a conversation that needs to be continued beyond the election, regardless of who it is that wins government.
All right, on that note, I think we'll end. Thank you very much for being here tonight for this very special inaugural joint episode of Policy Forum Pod and Democracy Sausage. It's been really great to have so many of you here and to have been able to, you know, have this kind of discussion. There's a range of issues we haven't got to discuss, but we will be continuing to make these podcasts. We'll be back in our normal cycle next week, and the week after Democracy Sausage, at least, we'll be doing another one of these. So that's the final week of the campaign. We'll be doing another one of these live podcasts. I'm not sure exactly of the venue yet, but we look forward to seeing as many of you as is possible coming back for that. And we'll, you know, endeavour to have some more interesting guests during that discussion as well. So thanks so much, Aunty Greta, Sharon and Nick, for your brilliant comments tonight. Thank you all for being here. And that's it. We'll see you again another time.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.